Hey, welcome everybody. This is the Thor and More. I don't know what the More part is going to be. I know we've got some Thor. These gentlemen will help me. My name is Joe Stuber. I produce and host Comic Book Central. We've got our guest on the panel today. You know him as an artist on Alpha Flight, Ultimate and Uncanny X-Men, and of course our favorite God of Thunder, Thor. Tom Rainey joins us today. And if you heard our discussion, writer and artist, he's worked on tons of different titles. We were just talking about Raiders of the Lost Ark over here. Fantastic Four, X-Factor, Avengers, two of my favorites, Star Wars. I know we've seen some Star Wars stuff there. Raiders of the Lost Ark, Mr. Walt Simonson. So yes, we will be chatting about Thor. I don't know what the More part is, but feel free to add the More part in as we go on. First of all, before we get all your Thor questions, get all your questions ready as we go through. We're going to throw it out to you guys here in a little bit. But we think about the character of Thor, and jump in wherever, you know, whoever wants to go first. But your earliest memories of the character, what was the appeal of the character for you? I think with me, I just remember the old Marvel cartoon, I think, back in the day when they took like Kirby art.
You young guy.
I know. But yeah, go talk, and you know the history, Walt, you know, the character, you know, beyond Marvel comics, beyond that. But your first thoughts on the character.
When I've talked to him, on, kick me, and then you can.
If you see that 15-minute sign in the back,
we're about done. And my first memory of Thor actually is really my parents' home. My dad had a number of books, not as many as I have, sadly, but he has lots of books, and they had a 2-volume set of mythology. One was Greek and Roman mythology, one was Norse mythology. And they were from 1893, I think they were, which wasn't as old when I was a kid as it would be now. and so I felt like I read Norse mythology, I read the book, I thought it was fantastic. I may have liked it, probably, you know, when you're a kid and death is a long way off, the whole idea that the gods die at the end of the Norse mythology cycle is just really, it's pretty amazing, really. It's just an amazing, there's a whole Ragnarok and a battle, all sorts of stuff. I thought that was great. So I knew about Thor, I got into mythology, I read a lot of it when I was young. I discovered the Thor comic, Journey into Mystery at the time, in 65. It had been coming out for about 3 years by then, so it was Journey into Mystery 120. It had started at 89, I think. It was 87, I think. And so they were already well into it, and they were, in retrospect for me, and it's still true, they were just hitting their stride. Jack had come back on the book after being gone for a while. Jack Kirby was the artist. Vinnie Colletti was inking, and Stan was writing it. And I was wowed. One short, turn over to you. That was why, and the idea they had a book on Norse mythology, I thought, on Thor was just fabulous. And honestly, there weren't comic fans as there are now, and of course, nothing I'm going to say applies to anybody in this room. But there were no fans in the way there are now. And so the fact that Thor's hair was blonde, that he wasn't wearing an iron glove to catch the hammer, he didn't have a couple of goats to pull his, I didn't care. I just thought it was great. I can imagine the web now would explode if somebody put out a book of Thor and he had blonde hair and no beard and no all that stuff. But I thought it was fantastic. And the fact that it wasn't exactly the mythology, I mean, that was fine. That was really cool. So, but I discovered it really. I grew up in Maryland in College Park, which is just outside Washington, D.C. And it turned out, I discovered Marvel Comics, but only by accident. There were only a few stores that carried, there was one drugstore chain that carried Marvel Comics back then where I lived. Nobody else had them. And so I happened to be at this drug fair one day, and my parents had driven there, it was about 5 miles from home, looking at the racks, and there were 2 issues of Thor on sale during Mystery at the same time, which doesn't normally happen. Normally when a new one comes in, the old ones go away. And it turned out to be the first 2 issues of what was a 4-part story. And I read them there in the, I went, oh, Thor, I read it at the stand, standing there, and thought, these are great. But, you know, look, I'm 19 when you're just going into my sophomore year. I was 19, well, almost, I was 18 right then, I had my birthday. And I thought, well, I'm too old and cool to buy comic books. So I left them there and went home. I thought, boy, those were great. Well, they were great stories. So I got on my bike and I rode the 5 miles back to the drugstore and I read the comics again. I still didn't buy them. I must have ridden back about 4 times. And finally said, oh, for goodness sake, buy the damn comic books. So those are my first two Marvel comics.
What was the guy running the store thinking every time?
You know, it was like a giant, like a Walgreens would be now. Nobody knew who it was, nobody cared. They, you know, you could stand and read comics forever. But I finally bought those two issues, issue 120, 121 of Journey to Mystery. And I was just hooked on that comic. And within about 4 months, you know, you get one and then you get hooked. And so then I was buying all the Marvel comics within about 3 or 4 months. At a time when Marvel had 11 titles. So
the gateway character. He was a gateway character.
He was. He was my gateway character in Marvel Comics. And he remained one of my 3 or 4 very favorite characters all the time I was reading Marvels pretty much through the rest of the 60s.
And Tom, how your introduction to the character and the appeal for you?
If I remember correctly, it was the little reprint pocketbooks that Marvel had done.
Oh, in the 70s.
Yeah, I kind of
full lived in color.
It was I lived in the boonies, so you know when I got
loved
books, those. It was, you know, one here, one there. You know, never know what you're gonna get. So that was a big thing for me. That and the big trades that they had that were like first issues of all
the treasury
stuff.
Size.
No.
Okay.
I can't remember the one with all the heroes, but they had to bring on the bad guys.
Yes.
You know, the one before that.
Okay.
The paperbacks.
Yeah,
I know it's a trade paperbacks. I've made different titles. I've heard of those.
Yeah, that introduced me to a lot of, you know, Marvel stuff.
Okay,
and they're just great. But the Thor comics was the reverse for me. You know, they introduced me to mythology, so ended up reading about that stuff afterwards.
Okay, what was the appeal
so
of the
comics first?
What was the appeal of the character? Because he's not. I mean, we like Superman, we like Batman, we like Spider-Man. These are sort of relatable characters. I mean, Clark Kent. I mean, even though he's Superman, we can relate to Clark Kent. We can relate to Peter Parker. Thor is completely out of left field. So what was the appeal? He's not the traditional superhero that we're all accustomed to. So what was the appeal of that? Or was it just...
I think that it was that different. You know, it was the appeal to me. You know, it just... He didn't seem so perfect like Superman. And he wasn't trouble. The way that Batman was, he wasn't relatable the way that Peter Parker was, but he was just fun in the difference.
Okay.
Yeah. He was also, I think, in the beginning. I mean, the very beginning, he was kind of a superhero. I mean, he was a limping guy who found a magic stick and who hit it and became a powerful guy, which is not. I mean, it's not too different from the model of Clark Kent Superman as a dichotomy, except that, of course, he really was a limping guy as opposed to a super guy who was pretending to be limpy. But it was still, you had these two different identities. He had, an ordinary identity and a superhero identity. And a lot of the early Thor comics are really pretty straight superhero daring do. They're really fighting Zarko, whatever his name was, in the future, and his giant robot, and saving humanity. So he wasn't doing a lot of different stuff. And Stan and Jack began introducing the mythological stuff pretty early. I think maybe the second issue even has Loki in it. I've forgotten. But pretty early Loki's in that stuff. And then he talks to his dad, and the big head of Odin appears in the sky. And then eventually you start getting... He goes back to Asgard, finally. So they begin introducing... And that's what really made Thor unique among the superhero books, is he began having this whole other life that was mythological, you know, based on the mythology. It wasn't super accurate, and they weren't trying to do the myths. Which I'm all in favor of. If you want to read the myths, you can go buy a book, and they're all right there. But he had a whole background, so he really had almost like a man of two worlds. That's a different company, but he had a couple different, he had Earth, and he saved people there. And in the Norse myths, Thor himself is kind of the god of a common man. Odin's more into the aristocrats or the guys like that, the guys at the top of the food chain. Thor's more the guys in the middle. And so he looked after Earth and fought the Frost Giants and kept things kind of cool for ordinary mortals. And was very popular among them during the Viking era. But he was a sort of a superhero early on, but then he became broader as this mythological background developed. And it really gave him a kind of a broad background and an interesting background that other superheroes, you know, maybe with the exception of Wonder Woman, which was, I thought, not as, in some ways, developed in a very different direction, but it wasn't quite... wasn't quite the same, and I just love the myths anyway, so I was thrilled about a comic that mythology was part of.
Now, how did the character of Thor come to you? You're coming on doing the writing, doing the art, doing all these different things on the book. When did that first come to you? And did you seek it out? Was that the character like I got to do this one, or did it just sort of come to you?
No, I was happy to get a paycheck for anything. As a freelancer, I was delighted to get paid and have the checks cashed. I started working for DC. I was there about 4 years, then I switched over to Marvel. What really happened was, we're here. Two things happened. One is that when I was in college, I read Marvel Comics. And then after college, I was a geology major. I decided that was not where I wanted to go. I took some time off. I went to art school because I could draw pictures and I didn't know what else to do, basically. So I went to art school, and while I was in art school, I got interested in comics, about doing them, actually. I had not thought of that before, but I thought about actually drawing comics, maybe. I didn't really think of myself as a writer, but I began drawing them, and I had had an idea for Thor. This is long before crossovers. This may be too long to explain. long before crossovers were around the way they are now, I had an idea about 1967 or so, where I loved Thor. There were a couple of Thor annuals that came out back in the 60s. There were more later, but there were two back then. That was cool. So my idea was to put more mythology. There's a big guy, a fire demon named Surtur, who's a big important guy in the Norse myths. He helps burn everything at the end of time. And in the comics, they had something called the Odin sword, which was this giant sword that sat in a sheath in Asgard, or as I want to Jack's giant things. And the idea was that when the sword was withdrawn from the scabbard, the universe would end. When they didn't say how that was going to work. They just, it was like, I'll pull the sword out. Oh, no, don't do it. And they put it back in. And so my idea as a 20-year-old, you're not quite a kid, but I wasn't really an adult, was I would to do a story that would start in an issue of Thor. And then that same month, it would be in all the Marvel comics, one chapter after another, and they would all be more or less self-sustaining, and it'd all come out in 1 month. And the following month, the annual would come out, which is a longer story, and that would have the 44 or 48 or whatever, however long it was, climax to the whole story. And the driving force, the MacGuffin for the story, is that I decided that the Odin sword... At the end of time in Ragnarok, Surtur takes a flaming sword and he lights the universe with it. Stars fall from the sky, the earth burns, it sinks into the ocean. Presumably Surtur himself disappears, whether he dies or not, it's not clear in the myths. But that's what was going to happen. And so I decided the Odin sword is Surtur's sword. Odin is holding it to keep Surtur from grabbing the sword early and destroying things, which because Surtur is just this big force of destruction, before it's time to destroy the universe. And so that was my story. And in the first issue of Thor, the one that came out that my magic month, basically everybody wakes up in the morning and the sword is gone. And it turns out that Surtur has been working out these magic spells for eons. And finally, because he and the sword are kind of one, I'm a big Lord of the Rings fan, so it's kind of the Sauron ring business, he sucks the sword back to Muspelheim and he has his sword. But it's not lit. And also in Asgard, and they were in one of the maps that Jack had drawn, there is the eternal flame of Asgard. They don't say anything about it. I have no idea what the eternal flame of, that's a big flame. And so I said, the deal is, Surtur has to get back to Asgard, light his sword in that flame. Once that happens, all hell breaks loose. There's no way to stop it. Ragnarok happens, and Surtur destroys everything. So the rest of the chapters are Surtur gathering his forces, all the various superheroes fighting these guys as they come into Earth, and then finally in the last chapter, Surtur invades Asgard himself, breaks the Rainbow Bridge, tries to get to the Eternal Flame. And I did that, and I drew about 26 pages of this final chapter of the epic for the annual. And after about 26, 27 pages, I said, wow, my inking really sucks. I have to think about this. I'll come back and do this when my inking is better. And so 14 years later, my inking was better. And I got to do the comic book Thor and write and draw it. So that's the story I started with. I couldn't do it in all the monthly books. I just did it all through Thor. And when we got to the end, we invited anybody who wanted to participate and just have demons or whatever you wanted to do that would kind of fit. Roger Stern actually did an issue of the Avengers where the fire demons are invading Manhattan and the Avengers fight them. And some other guys did Tips of the Hat. That was kind of right before crossovers became what they are today. But that was really... So... And I got the gig doing Thor. I had talked to Mark Gruenwald. We, shoot the breeze in the office all the time. It's back when the companies were in New York. They had to live in New York to do comics. So you were always in the office. It was really a social clan as well as a professional group. And so we chatted about it. I'm sure I told him about the story. And at some point, he got a hold of me and said, well, listen, you want to write and draw Thor? And I had done Thor for a year in the 70s. I had drawn it. I'd done layouts for it. Len Wein had written it. And I said, sure, I'd love to go back and I'd love to write it. And so we talked about it. And Mark was completely game for anything I wanted. If I wanted to kill Thor, have somebody else find the hammer and become a new Thor, anything I wanted to do was going to be fair game. And I thought, well, I'm going to back and do this Surtur story. That's going to be my first story. Ran longer than I thought I was going to, but that was really, but that's how that happened, and that's how I got the book. It really wasn't, I didn't go seeking, I didn't try to, I didn't, and I'd done Thor already for a year.
Fortuitous.
It was fun, but it was fortuitous. I mean, everything just kind of came together at the right moment, and then I got to do that story after. And my inking was better.
And you get to do a lot of crazy things on the book too. Something, and so that's, you know, the, and we'll talk about that. So I want to throw it out to the fans out there. I know right here, I know you got the whole history of Walt Simonson in there. But
Where did Beta Ray Bill come from? And then there was like a frog version of Thor I saw in the issue. Was that from the mythology, or was that something that?
Speaking of crazy things, not exactly.
If you, I'll give you the short version on Bill. If you're interested, if you're on Facebook, I have a page called the Official Walter Simonson Page. Because I'm too lazy to have a real website. And Facebook makes it really easy for me. If they can data mine me for stuff, God bless them. So, but one of the things you can do in those pages, you can put notes up. And so if you find the notes on the, and if you're a member of Facebook, you find that page, you like it, and you can see all the content. And there's a, there's a, there is there a long note in which I give a more detailed version of Bill. All it really was that, you know, Thor had been around about, what was that, 60, 83, a little over 20 years when I started doing it. That means an awful lot of stories have been done. And as a writer, you'd kind of like to not tell the same stories that have been told over and over again. I mean, that does, it's not always possible. A lot of stuff has echoes of old stuff. But I thought about it, and I decided that in Thor, it occurred to me that really no one's ever picked up the hammer. And the deal with the hammer is probably bigger than nose. It's got a magic inscription on it, which appears at the writer's whim, which says, whosoever holds this hammer, if he be worthy, shall possess the power of Thor. I thought, well, it'd be kind of cool if somebody else comes along and can actually pick the hammer up, get Thor's power. And so Bill was designed from the ground up to be that guy. I made him ugly, because I'm a monster, because mostly in comics back then, it was very much a short form. Comics came out this week, and then they were gone next week, and then you didn't see them again. There weren't comic shops and a lot of back issues available and stuff like that. It was boom, 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 boom. And so the idea was that mostly bad guys looked like monsters. If it was a monster, he was a bad guy. Mostly bad girls wore less clothing. So that's kind of how it worked. So, but you use these kind of tropes to, as a shortcut to meaning, because you've got 22 pages, and sometimes less, to tell a whole story. So you don't have to explain all this stuff. You want to be able to have some meaning be instant. So I designed Bill like a monster. It's not that the hammer was a tailor and gave him a new set of clothes, but when he picked it up and it became the hammer, I gave him a very Thor costume, because then I don't have to explain what just happened. The minute you see that, you know, oh man, he's got Thor's powers. So that's how that a lot of that stuff worked. But I made him but he's an ugly guy, so at first you think he's a bad guy. He picks up the hammer, and I had readers freaking out. How can a bad guy pick up? Don't you understand how Thor works?
It's not worthy.
And as a writer, what you want to do is you want to play fair with your readers, but you want to mislead them. And boy, nobody, I mean, maybe people claim this now, nobody gets back to me now and says, oh, I always knew Bill was a good guy. Then when he picked the hammer up, I said, because I, you know, they only the inscription. Look, he's got to be a good guy. He picked the hammer up. But they thought I was, well, I was playing with them, but I wasn't screwing with the continuity. So that's really, Bill was really designed. And the only reason he has that name is that, I read a lot of science fiction in the old days. And in really pulp stuff, the way that would normally work, if Tom here were an alien and we meet, I have like a little alien translating gizmo that's never seen this alien or the language before, but I can turn it on, and when he talks, it comes out in English, and vice versa. So we're covered. So my feeling is that Beta Ray Bill, whatever his real name is, that's the name the Universal Translator spat out. That's all I could make sense out of whatever. And I guess that he lips. I don't know how he can talk. He probably can't say a word B or the letter B. You know, I'm not sure how good he is in consonants. But that's what it really is. And the reason the name is really there is that I want the name Bill. Originally I was going to say Beta Ray Jones, because what I wanted, he's like, even though he's the superb specimen of his race, he's kind of the representative of every man for that whatever his race was. I've been named since then. I didn't name it. But as every man,
Corbinite,
like,
I think it was.
Well, they're Corbinite, but I didn't name them. Right. I think it was Michael only. But the deal is that I wanted a common name. You know, the most common name I think is Johnson in English. Smith, Johnson, Jones, that kind of stuff. And so I chose one of those names the Universal Translator spit out for Everyman. But the trouble with Jones is there was a Louise Jones editing. There was a Rick Jones in the Hulk. They were publishing Indiana Jones right at that moment. And there may have been more guys with that. I don't remember. I said, again, too many Joneses. I can't do that. So I just wanted Bill because Bill is a, you know, it's a common name. Bill's a common nickname. It's an Everyman name. And I did Beta Ray because it's alliterative. I learned some stuff from Stan. Got that
alliteration. That's where the Stanley alliteration would come in because there's only like Peter Parker. You know,
and, you know, gamma rays were already taken. That's part of their it's part of the Hulk. You know, alpha rays just sound wimpy. I mean, really, it's a helium nucleus. It's like two protons, two neutrons, I think, isn't it?
You need to eat it in order to get poisoned by it.
So I just, and so beta rays, if you know beta rays, I think they're just like electrons. There's not much to them, really, but it sounded better with Bill. Yeah. So that's how that name came to be. But that's how the character was. It was really, he was designed from the ground up to be a guy who could pick up the hammer. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, nobody else can do it. And all my friends who have written stories about other guys picking up the hammer, they're just all wrong. I love them all dearly. They're just all wrong.
Chris Evans moved it slightly.
Well,
so we know there's something. Know, there may be something.
Maybe. I don't think Captain Earth did pick it up. I'm sorry.
He didn't pick it up, but he did move it slightly. So we talk about design and characters, too. What's it like coming in with a character that has this much history and you want to respect the original creators and that look, but then you want to kind of bring your own element to it? So for any budding artists out there or people that might get an iconic character to draw one of these days, how do you approach a character like that, still bring your sensibilities into it, and then still respect the past so it's not a completely off-the-wall version of it?
Well, when I got on it, it was kind of get in and go. So it was a
get
whole
it done.
Lot of time. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I got my hands on, you know, some Viking photos, you know, just for reference. Got out my old Jack Kirby stuff and just kind of looked for something to fit in between the two.
Okay.
Unfortunately, when I was doing the book, I wasn't stuck with just what I came up with, and they let me basically make up something new just about every issue.
Okay.
So it was just having fun, and yeah.
So do you have the Kirby work kind of around you as inspiration, and you want to bring this, like, do you remember, like, what elements you wanted to make sure that you had in, and what you're like, oh, that's a little...
It's going back quite a while now, but, you know, it was kind of just the big overall shapes and the graphic patterns that that Jack brought in.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to go with that, but also still use kind of the runics and symbols and, you know, things like that.
Okay. Let's throw it out to... Oh, we got a question right here up front.
I know you mentioned 14 years ago you had started with a comic, one from DC Marvel, and I was just kind of wondering, you went to art school. Is that kind of your background? And also, you, Tom, did you go to art school? Did you just walk in and do an interview and say, like, hey... Like, I know you said you were just about to get a paycheck. So where did you kind of start with, kind of, if we wanted to get into the, you know, business?
How do you become a great artist?
You know, I will say that I don't understand comics now, mainstream comics. So I'm going to be able to worry. Tom is younger than I am. He'll always be younger than me. So he may have a better
new
idea.
New generation.
I mean, the deal now is, I mean, I said somebody recently, a couple of years ago I drew a cover for Marvel. It was a variant cover for something. They said, I went Beta Ray Bill fighting for. So, okay, cool. I think Paul Mount's color did a really lovely job. A very electric color. Looked really cool. Nice drawing. It comes out. I get a copy. And it's there. I've got my comp, and it's a copy of Hawkeye. Now I have, and I'm going, well, I'm glad the check cleared, because I got no idea. I don't have, you know, they ask me to do something, I'm happy to do it. And especially I like doing it if something I want to draw. But really, so for me, the way it actually worked was when I went to art school, I went to the Rhode Island School of Design in Providence, and I was there for 3 years. I was really a transfer student. And my junior year, we had to do a kind of a long project, and I began doing a comic book, a science fiction comic, pulp science fiction, called The Star Slammers. And it had other things. It was actually being published, but not related to the school, in a very modern ash can way. And when I got to be a senior, I was still working in the story, and I was able to bring that story over as I kept working on it and make it into my degree project. It became my senior thesis, essentially. And they were good with it. As far as I know, it's the first comic anybody did at RISD as a senior thesis. But 2 years later, another guy was doing one. But it was the first one they'd done. I'm really old. 1969, 70, 71, 72 is when this was happening. So nobody in the school really knew comics. they weren't comic artists. I mean, now a lot of schools, I'm sure, have guys that were hip to comics, if not teaching them. And but I had guys that knew. They knew drawing, they knew costume, they knew perspective, they knew design, they knew typography, they knew all the stuff that went into it. And I taught myself the storytelling. I learned how to put pictures together. And if I have any gifts in comics, that's the thing I can do. I'm better at that than I am at everything else I do in comics. I can put pictures together in a way that tells a cool story. And that's, which to me is the essence of comics, so I'm happy to be. You're the guys that draw better than me, but I would like to be able to do this and draw as well as Jose Garcia Lopez, but I can't do that. But
well, yeah, that's a pretty high bar. I think even in your, was it in your first issue? Was like the doom?
Yes. That was the opening.
Yeah, like we don't even know what's going on, and but we know there's a story. We know there's a backstory. We're intrigued, and you got our attention right off the bat. So I think
I lucked out. That was about my eighth professional writing job, so I didn't have a lot of experience. I was really
talking about storytelling, and that is just.
But that worked out really well. But so when I graduated from ISTE, I had it was about 50 or 60 pages long. Star Slammers, the first half is really pretty decent fan work, but it's not more than that. The last half begins to become professional. I began to learn things like, what happened simply was I went to New York. You can't do this. That's why I can't help you a whole lot now. I don't think Marvel or DC looks at portfolios anymore, do they, really? Maybe at conventions, but they don't take submissions in the office.
Yeah,
is my impression. So you might look on their websites. They may have information on their websites about submitting stuff. I don't know how that works. I mean, I made an appointment. I went into DC in 1970, in August of 70. Actually, it was this month, right at the beginning of the month. I went into DC, had my little it was cardboard taped together in the bottom with like duct tape or something with my artwork. And I was not big on presentation, and so I took it in there. And I had my appointment with an editor, and but science fiction is before Star Wars. Science fiction was a very small ghetto in comics. It was very small. And one of the things I figured out really quickly is that as an artist, you are often typed. They say, oh, this guy can do great science fiction, but he's crummy at Westerns and other, or he's really good at superheroes, but he's not. And so I worked very hard once I got in to try and do jobs in different genres. I mean, now it's mostly superheroes. But there were more genres back then that were available, just through mainstream. Now with independence, you can do anything, but there were, but in at Marvel and DC. So I took my portfolio, I showed it to the editor, he said, well, this is nice, what else can you do? And I was green. I thought, well, it shows I can draw, it shows I can tell a story, it shows I can design. Of course I can draw Spider-Man. Well, it's, Superman was DC. But obviously, I understand.
But you have a Spider-Man in there.
But now I understand that if you're not drawing those guys, editors aren't going to make the leap to say, this guy can really draw a fat, which I totally get now. I didn't then exactly. I understand what's going on. And then through a complete fluke, and it's too long to explain, but a complete fluke, I ended up having the editor-in-chief of DC, or editorial director, whatever his name title was then, Carmen Infantino, looked at my work. He got the portfolio, got put on his desk. He looked at it. He really liked it. Now, Carmine's own art, if you've seen it, is very designy. It's kind of linear, especially back in those days. And he really responded to it. So the next thing I know, I'm sitting in Carmine's office talking about comics for 10 minutes. Now, I remember nothing of that conversation. except that he liked it, and he wondered if I had been influenced by Bernie Krigstein. I don't know if any of you guys know Krigstein's work. He was an artist back in the end of the 40s, early into the 50s. He eventually got out of comics, became an illustrator. For some time, as an older guy, he would deny he was the Bernie Krigstein who had done comic books, because back then that was not something you want on your resume. But he did 4 or 5 jobs for EC Comics back then that are completely brilliant. I would use stronger language when we had kids in the audience. So, but they were incredibly brilliant jobs. In other jobs, they're very popular. But he was a phenomenal artist. But his brilliance, a lot of it, it's very linear, it's very designy. I had not really seen Krigstein's work at that time. So I couldn't respond in a way that said, oh yeah, I'm totally into Krigstein. So But Carmine liked my stuff. And so he called 3 of his editors into his office, including the guy who had turned me down earlier, and made them all give me a backup story.
Oh, wow.
So I walked out of his office with three short stories. Again, back then comics had, a lot of comics had a lead feature and a backup story. And the backup stories could be 3, 4, or 5 pages long. A lot of new guys in the business right then did those stories because you could learn your craft in the back of the comic, where if your work was really awful, it didn't kill the comic book. And you could make enough money, $40 a page for pencils and inks, or less, to make a living. And at that time, you could find an apartment in New York City, in Brooklyn or Queens or somewhere a long way from Manhattan for about $100 a month. So you could make enough money to kind of stay alive, yeah, buy Hamburger Helper, and keep going for a while.
When and hone your craft.
And hone your craft. And so and the funny thing is, the guy turned me down. I did one story for him. Liked the story I did for him. We did a few more stories. I did several more for his war books he was doing. And finally, when Archie Goodwin wanted to do Manhunter, he said, "I'm doing this new guy. Do you want to be the artist on them? So I'd done enough stuff outside science fiction with that, and Archie decided I could draw stuff besides science fiction. But I did work at that pretty hard to try and get things. My first couple jobs were SF, and so I tried to kind of get out of that patch as quickly as I could.
And Tom, how do you become a successful superstar artist?
Well, when I get there, I'll let you know. But when I got in, I went to Kubert School, and the method was pretty much the same. You get out, you call up, you set up an interview, and you know, they tell you to come back afterwards.
You didn't have cardboard all taped together, Pat?
You had no, this whole portfolio. They actually gave you a portfolio at school. So,
you had a professional portfolio.
Joe Kubert's example. When he went for his first interview, he had his stuff racked up in the newspaper.
Oh, I feel much better.
Yeah.
He was also working at 13.
He was.
Yeah. Wow. But yeah, you know, you could just call up Marvel or DC back then and set up an appointment. And editors did want to look at your stuff. And after months of hounding them, I warmed down enough to get something.
Perseverance. Perseverance. Just
one thing you'll find is, I mean, sometimes you'll look at a guy's stuff and you'll, you know, this is nice, you'll come give him a critique or whatever. And somebody will say, well, you know, look, I'm as good as Joe Blow or somebody, you know, Joe Blitzflig. And there'll be some really crummy artist who does get work in comics. And you can say, well, yeah, but why would some other editor hire you when you're just as lousy as that guy?
Right.
I mean, they're already giving that guy where they've already got that guy.
Yeah.
They're already paying him $3 a page. Why would they want to switch and pay you $3 a page for more work that's at the bottom of the pile? So you really have to be better than that.
Or bring something different to the table,
and,
too.
And, yeah, so it's really, if you say, well, you know, my work's as good as, and you look carefully at it, the guy's at the bottom of the food chain, it's just not going to help you. You got to have something better than that to offer.
And not to mention, you're telling the editor that his choice really isn't very good.
Not the best thing during a job interview?
Yeah.
No, that's
very good advice for budding artists.
It's amazing when people will tell editors sometimes you're thinking, what are you thinking?
Yeah.
Just like,
you have another question?
Oh, we're done. We've answered every question.
All the way. Question that's ever been in the history of Marvel Comics has been answered now. All the way in the back. Real loud voice.
Why a frog?
Oh, I got away from that. Because in fairy tales, that's what the handsome prince almost always gets turned into. Not always. I mean, sometimes it's a swan, but swans aren't funny. Frogs are innately funny. And it's like Charles Schulz, who did Peanuts, he had one little thing with Linus, where Linus had a lazy eye, had amblyopia, and he had to go to an ophthalmologist. He got an eye patch and wore it for a while. It was actually a nice little educational sequence. It was very clever. But he got Schulz got taken to task by optometrists who said, really should be an optometrist and you know, then an ophthalmologist. I don't know the difference myself. But what Schulz said was, look, basically the idea is that optometrist is not a funny word. Ophthalmologist is a funny word. That's the difference. And that's exactly, that was it. So frogs are kind of funny. But I did think, I mean, I make notes about stories. When I'm working on Thor, I'm always thinking about stuff. I'm making notes, a story idea, just a brief spark. Sometimes it's a whole story. By the time I'm done with a book like that, I have more stories in my files than I have that I've been able to actually put in a comic book. And one of the notes that I had, all it said was really a tip of the hat to Carl Barks. For those who don't know, Carl Barks was an artist who worked for Walt Disney Comics and Stories and Disney Animator originally, and he drew the Donald Duck and his nephew's adventures for Walt Disney Comics and Stories for about 25 years, from the late 40s to the mid-70s, I think, somewhere in there. And he also invented Uncle Scrooge, he invented Gyro Gearloose, he invented Gladstone Gander, all these supporting characters that were in the comic. Scrooge spun off into his own book, which Barks also wrote and drew. In the old days, it was quarterly, so that would come out four times a year. But he was a brilliant, brilliant writer and artist. He he may still be my favorite guy that's done comics. Once you get up in that range, you start talking about him and Kurtzman and Kirby and some other guys, and I understand there'd be a limited number of those guys, but what Barks was able to do consistently for so long was astonishing. And so I kind of want to do a tip of the hat to Carl Barks. I never met him, one of my big regrets, but you know, what can you do? And so I reached a point in my storylines where I said, "Hey, well, you know, I could do this enchantment." I don't even know how it worked. I just suddenly somehow brainstormed, and I went, "Wow, this is my chance." And so, but I thought about it. I thought, well, probably can't do a duck. For one thing, Marvel already had Howard the Duck. And I really didn't want to draw any parallels or have to have some analysis of why Howard the Duck is better, you know, whatever. And so I thought of it. I said, well, fairy tales, man, like Grimm's fairy tales, all that stuff. It's the Frog Prince. And so that, and at the time, I was living just off Central Park West on the west side. So we knew Central Park pretty well. We didn't get up to the reservoir that often. There's a reservoir up there. And also, if you walk around the park, you will occasionally see signs posted in corners that say, rat poison scattered here, don't let your dogs or eat anything, or that kind of stuff. Warnings, rat poisonous area. And so the idea of the rat-frog war kind of came along. And also, I was in college, I wrote it, and it's a little Aristophanes, the birds, and the, what's the other one he wrote that still exists? There's two of them, the animal fables, that are very satirical things, but they're animals. And I thought, well, you know, this, I'm not claiming Aristophanes as my mentor, don't get me wrong. But I had that thought, and I liked the idea, and so it became this, the Rat-Frog War in Central Park. And that really, it's a parody of my own stuff, and a high fantasy, you know, it's the Frog Princess, and the guy, the hero rides in on his horse from how far, and it's been another million westerns, it's been an heroic fantasy. And he puts down the rats, and then I got to do the crocodiles in the sewer, and the alligators in the sewer, the old New York urban legend as well. So I try to get a bunch of that urban stuff kind of mixed into that storyline when I was doing it.
Was there any pushback at all?
No.
As the crazier you got with some of these things, or was it just like, it's selling? So
it's comic books. Nobody cared. Yeah. I mean, I will say that comics now, this is 30 years ago, comics now are much more corporate. I think that's a fair statement. And that means that suits have a great deal more to do with what comics come out and how crossovers are done, all sorts of stuff that's not creative. The short, not that bookkeeping can't be creative, but it's the short version of this is that when I was doing comics on 4, and up to in that career, my career, up until like about 1990, my feeling is comics were mostly, creativity was from the bottom up. Editors hired a team on the book. That team mostly stayed on the book as long as that editor was there. When the editor quit, usually a new editor comes in. He or she has different ideas where the book should be going. They usually let those guys go and hire new guys. In the old days, they tried to find other work for those guys, the guys that were let go. That doesn't happen so much now. But really, once you're on a book, like on Thor, I mean, I had two editors. I had the late Mark Grunewald, that Ralph Macchio. And, you know, I just told stories. And I never got any pushback on that stuff. I just did the stories I wanted to do. The book was selling okay. I was left alone. Now, I feel that creativity is more top-down. There are three or four guys, friends of mine, guys who are very creative, but they do these giant crossovers, do all this other stuff that you have to actually get out there and play in that sandbox. And I'm not as interested in that. If you'll notice, I'm not doing that much work for Marvel and DC right now. I'm doing my own independent book called Ragnarok. I've gone back to Norse Smith's. But I've gone back to Norse Mist now for the first time in 30 years. And I get to do my own stuff and whatever I kind of want to do, which is makes a big difference.
Got a good question in the back. Another question. Yep, right up front here.
When you're writing a cave story, do you think there's a line to cross when you get where you don't want to be too cheesy, but you also don't want to take yourself too seriously because what you're doing is kind of almost innately silly? So, like, do you think the best way to really write an entertaining comic story is to be somewhere in between, or to just go all one way?
You know, I think the answer, this is what I learned from Stan and Jack on the Fantastic Four, on Thor, a lot of other comics, is that you keep a straight face. If you keep a straight face and tell your story, you can get away with almost anything. Because I'm not there to make fun of the reader. I'm there to bring the reader along, to help the reader enjoy stuff. So if you read the Rat, I mean, the Rat Frog War is sort of a parody in it, but it's also a very straight story of a strong frog who helps out some frogs in Central Park at the reservoir who are in trouble. because they're and the rats are going to put rat poison, all the rat poison into the reservoir, which is going to be bad for people. So there's a very straight element, but it's also very silly. But the idea is I don't break faith with the reader. I don't try to go, you know, one of these like nudge, nudge, wink, wink, aren't we clever, isn't this funny? I find that stuff really annoying when that happens. It's like, either be clever enough, tell me your story, or shut up. So both, basically on that stuff, I just try to play straight with the reader, but I try to keep a straight face in the work I do at the same time, because I believe in it. I believe the stories. I mean, I understand some of them are pretty silly. That's okay, I don't mind that. But I want to, well, that's really it. I don't want to break faith with the readers who are reading this stuff. I'm not there to tell jokes. I'm there to have humor in the stories, hopefully derived from the characters themselves. But really, it's just a straight story about what I'm doing.
Is that how it works for you? I mean, that would you have anything to add to that kind of a... Anything else for how you do stories?
I think you nailed it. Yeah, you do have to respect the reader. And, not assume that, that it's just kid stuff. Or it's, joking around. You can do it as silly as you want, as long as you have a certain degree of grounding and, like you said, believe in it. That's got to be the first point you make.
How do you think the character of Thor has been handled now? We talk about the movies, and I know you may be a little biased, Walt, because you and your wife have a cameo, I think, in the first movie. Can we see you? Where can we see you in the movie?
I was waiting for my Oscar nomination. I'm so annoyed.
You and Stan Lee, you're both waiting for your Oscar nomination.
It hasn't arrived.
No, I think my
special
staff
cameo Oscar. They use a cameo Oscar. That's right.
Yeah, well, somewhere out as far as you can get.
But how do you think the character's been handled now in the movies? Because we've got one of your characters in the Dark World now. Malekith is in there.
Two of them, Malekith and Curse.
Okay, so we see these things. So talk a little bit. I mean, Tom, you can mention, like, are you a fan of the movies? Do you kind of look at this, or like, well, I would have done this, or something? I can't believe it.
I go to the movies to, go along with the ride. I enjoyed them a lot. I think they're great.
I mean, do you think they nailed the spirit of the character, or do you think they've done enough for the history?
For me, they did. Okay. I'd love to see more of the history brought in. But if all we get is the two that they've done, I'm happy with that. They're fun.
I think it's going to get a little crazier in the third one, too.
We'll see what happens.
And Walt, what was your experience?
The thing about the four movies I really love is simply that I think that Marvel in general in their movies, I've not seen all of them, I've seen a lot of them, has done a phenomenal job casting their films. And Chris Hemsworth and Tom Hiddleston, the two of them, I don't care what else happens in those films, those two together are hysterical. Chris is a fabulous straight man, and Tom is a riot. And they were just, the two of them together, I think, that's where those movies really shine. When those two are together, those movies just click like you can't believe. And I'm thrilled by that they got the two of those guys to do it. I think they were phenomenally good choices. And that's what those movies are. They're a buddy movie between Thor and Loki. They hate each other. They're detectives. Whatever. The two of them are just such a riot together that I hope there's one more film. I guess there's going to be one more film at least. And I hope they're able to do as well with the writing in the two of those characters. For me, that's where the real heat in those movies are. Now, Natalie Portman's fine, don't get me wrong. But I really thought the heat in those films is between those two characters, which in a lot of ways is probably where it should be. So I'm totally good with that. And then, as far as my cameo, if you ever watch the first movie again, if you go to at the end, there's a banquet scene, and they have all these the Asgardians, the warriors three in the middle, and some supporting characters on either side. And if you look straight at the table, well, from your angle, Sif's over here on this corner, the warriors three in the middle, next to Fandral is a lovely girl who's an extra, and then me, and then Sif. And I do have a nanosecond of screen time, but I look more like this because apparently Asgardians don't wear glasses. So I'm completely blind in the scene. They wanted me to eat something. The food was all real. It was a phenomenal feast. They wanted me to go over there. One guy called their assistant guy, I'm going to eat some of the food. And the trouble with that is that the utensils, these huge, sharp knives, this big fork. They had their own stands. They were so large, their own little stands on them, so you put them down. And I'm going, all I gotta do is try and cut the chicken. I'm gonna cut my finger off. So I think I'll just eat some grapes. So
this giant grape. I mean, they're using actual props with these things.
I think they were the real thing.
Yeah.
They were real good. And I think none of that stuff made it in the film. There was actually a little dialogue in The Warriors 3. None of that made it in the film. I'm laughing like a loon. And that's the clip they put in, thank you very much. And a joke that nobody sees or hears. But it was still, we were on the set for 3 days. I got to lie in the Odin bed, so I've been moving much longer than I expected to. And it was just...
You're just taking crazy pictures when you're there?
We didn't really take pictures on the set. We probably could have. They would have let us. I think they didn't want anything getting out. I mean, the weird thing was, we went back with Ralph Macchio, my editor on the book for 30 years ago, and Wheezy were also there. They're in the film. If you know where to look, like, you see Wheezy from the back, mostly from the side, so it's hard to recognize her. But we went back to where we had our dressing room, which is actually an unused office. They had some office furniture pushed over to the side and stuff. But they had our names on the outside, which is hysterically funny. And so we took some photographs of the three of us standing in our Asgardian. Because the costumes were complete. We actually had shoes. They had made sewn leather shoes. And we had this big metal belt buckle, and we had these leather... I had these big leather gauntlets that went on over your hand. And the trouble with them is they were super stiff leather. So when you tried to eat, you could pick up a grape and go... You had to stick to your elbow, so it was hard to get in your mouth. But we took photographs, and then, and also, when we were getting ready to leave, I talked to one of the guys, Chris, who was one of the assistant producers or whatever he was. He was our main minder. And I said, we were getting ready to leave. I said, we haven't signed any NDAs yet. It was just a non-disclosure agreement. We've seen all this stuff. And he said, oh, you guys are family, it's fine. And my thought was, I'm sorry, what? I mean, we're on this movie, we're seeing all this stuff. We could have taken photographs. We're enjoying it too much. We talked to everybody.
So interested in it, yeah.
We didn't see Natalie Portman, but she was off. They'd be filming in Arizona, Mexico, wherever it was. I didn't really see Anthony Hopkins. He wasn't filming. We were, on the other hand, Ralph and I, in our full Asgardian robes, were walking up to the elevator back to our office, back to our dressing room. The door opens up. Anthony Hopkins is standing there in his full Asgardian Odin outfit, minus the eye patch. We looked at him, he looked at us, and I just said, my lord. He smiled and walked on down the hall. And that was it. That was all that happened. So that was it.
We got about 2 minutes here. I want to make sure we're talking a little bit about what you guys are working on now. Tom, what can we expect from you? And when you're down there, what can we have you sign while we're down there? What can we pick up?
You can sign anything you want. I'll sign anything.
And what are you working on now?
Anything with a blank check.
True. It wouldn't do good.
What's the latest thing you're working on now?
Right now, I've got an anthology called Broken Frontier. We kickstarted a couple months ago. I'm doing a story with Greg Pak in it called Phantom Limb Ghost Puncher.
Nice.
He sees dead people, and he hits it.
Website?
It's Broken Frontier.
There you go. And Walt, what do you want?
I'm doing a creator-owned book called Ragnarok for IDW. It comes out kind of irregularly. I'm sorry. The last issue is due out any time. I think probably, I'm guessing not this Wednesday, but the following Wednesday. It's 6 issues. It's the first arc of what I hope will be a multiple arc story I'll be doing for some years down the road. Essentially, Ragnarok's already happened. The gods are already dead. Thor wasn't there. The bad guys won. And now after hundreds of years, Thor has come back to find that the bad guys rule the 9 worlds, which have all, because the gods are gone, the worlds have all collided together to make one vast dust land. The sun and the moon lie inside the carcasses of the giant wolves that ate them on the ground, glowing inside. So everything's kind of a dusk. There's no bright sunlight. There's no day. There's no night. And Thor has come back without knowing what's happened. He finds out very quickly he's going to be pissed. And the first 6 issues are really the setup for this whole story. Ask really fast.
All right, so how did you deal with Marvel on that?
Hey, they don't own Thor. I'm not using the Thor logotype.
Okay.
It's called Ragnarok. I don't have a shirt on. I have a shirt that has a Ragnarok. So I've just, so far they haven't sent me a cease and desist letter. I'm very grateful.
And he looks nothing like Chris Hemsworth.
He also has no lower jaw right now, so it's kind of like, it's not quite zombie Thor, but he kind of looks like a zombie Thor.
Big hand for these gentlemen here. Big hand.